Blue Dot, Episode 9, The Science and Technology of Baseball.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem.
And I'm Matt Schiltz, and it is that time of year, Dave.
Spring is in the air, and soon, so will be baseballs.
Flying all over the air.
Flying out of stadiums near you. So opening day, Matt, it's right around the corner. April 4th, Major League Baseball has its opening day. And for me personally, the real opening day is April 7th when the Dodgers visit the Giants. And it's an even year. I hate to say it, but it is.
It is an even year. And what's happened the last three even years?
I'm not going to say.
Okay.
But you can probably ask somebody and they'll tell you.
Ask a baseball fan near you.
I think it's bad luck for me to mention it. So okay. I'm just going to say it's an even year and leave it at that.
Well, luckily our job is not to worry too much about the fates of the Giants or any other baseball team. We are going to talk about the science of baseball.
Yeah, the physics of baseball. Baseball's fascinating. There's so much interesting physics, and there's so many things that I would like to know more about. Like, how do you throw a curveball, and why does it curve? Why do some balls go flying out and are home runs and some don't? And there are physics answers to those questions. And so we're going to talk to Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois, Alan Nathan, who's an expert on the physics of baseball, and he's a real baseball fan, too. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Does understanding these concepts about physics help one enjoy or appreciate the game more in any way, do you think?
Well, it certainly does for me. So when I look at a game these days, depending, of course, on what game I'm watching, if I'm watching my beloved Boston Red Sox, I'm pretty well emotionally tied up in the game. But if I'm just watching another game, and I really like to watch all kinds of baseball, I really do look for things that are, indicative of phenomena that I've studied, or I try to find new interesting phenomena based on what I observe. So in some sense, the game is the big laboratory where an experimentalist does his experimental work. You observe the game, you see phenomena, you try to understand those phenomena. So yeah, I this actually does, for me, contribute to my enjoyment of the game. I don't know that it does for everyone, but certainly it does for me.
What are some of the interesting physical phenomena involved that you could share with our listeners?
So the kinds of things that I've looked at fall into sort of two broad categories. One is the physics of the ball-bat collision, and the other is the aerodynamics of a baseball in flight through the air. So when you look, for example, at the ball-bat collision, nowadays it's becoming more and more popular to actually show high-speed video of the ball-bat contact. And when you look at such videos, there are some amazing things that you see. You can see that bat vibrate. Sometimes it vibrates so much that it almost looks like it's getting knocked out of the batter's hands. You can see the spin of the batted ball. Lots and lots of different things that you can see when you've got the right tools for looking at it. So regarding the aerodynamics, lots of phenomena, whether it's a pitched baseball or a batted baseball, lots of things come into play. So one of my favorite things, when they show you a game on television, you look from the center field camera, you can really see the movement of the pitch. And trying to understand that movement, trying to tie it in with things that I've studied, is quite a pleasurable experience.
Explain to us a little bit about how do those pitches with a lot of movement on them compared with just, a basic fastball? Like, how does a curveball work, and how does a changeup work, and a slider? What is it that's going on there that the pitcher's doing that causes the ball to do that?
So the things that the pitcher has under his control that are designed in some sense to fool the batter are the speeds of the pitches. He can change that speed. So a changeup is slower than a fastball. A curveball is even slower than a changeup, typically. He can adjust the spin of the ball, both the rate at which it's spinning, revolutions per minute, as well as the spin axis. And I would say that primarily it's the spin axis and it's the speed that sort of in a broad sense, one type of pitch from another. So a fastball is, as the name suggests, it's the fastest pitch thrown, you know, in the 90s, mid-90s mile an hour at release, and it typically has backspin on it. So the movement on a pitch will depend on how rapidly it's spinning and the axis about which it's spinning. So when it has backspin, the so-called Magnus force on a spinning baseball is an upward force, and that tends to make the ball stay up longer. It's going to eventually drop because gravity is pulling it down, and the Magnus force is not high enough to totally counteract gravity. So the pitch doesn't rise, it does fall. But a so-called four-seam fastball is the straightest of all pitches. It falls the least and is usually very little lateral movement on it. If the pitcher tilts the spin axis by adjusting his arm slot, he can turn some of that backspin into side spin, typically giving rise to a riding action that tends to move in the direction of the throwing hand. So from a right-handed pitcher to a right-handed batter, that ball will go in towards a right-handed batter. So a curveball, on the other hand, is thrown with topspin. So when a ball is thrown with topspin, the Magnus force is down in the same direction as gravity, and so that type of pitch is going to drop much more than a typical fastball. And there's also some side spin on it that generally moves in the opposite direction as a fastball moves. It moves glove side rather than arm side. So all these things are ways that the pitcher has under his control to try to upset the timing of a batter, changing the speed and especially changing the spin axis.
So for a batter then, if to drive a ball, say they're a power hitter, like a Hunter Pence or somebody big, they want to get backspin on it so that the ball rises and goes out of the stadium, right?
Yeah, so the same physics is involved in a batted ball as is involved in a pitch ball. The physics is all the same. The details, of course, are different. So in order to get the ball to travel a long ways, basically you need three things. You need to hit the ball as hard as possible, or in the language that people use these days, you want a large exit velocity. You want the speed of the ball coming off the bat to be large. So for a typical home run, that's around 100 miles an hour. Okay? You want the ball to be hit at something close to the optimum vertical launch angle. In physics 101, it's 45 degrees. You know, in the absence of any aerodynamic effects, if it's just acting under gravity, it's 45 degrees. But in the presence of the air, which introduces a lot of drag on the ball, that optimum angle is much, much smaller. It's somewhere, 25 to 30 degrees. So you hit the ball around 25 to 30 degrees. That's the second thing you want to do, to hit it a long ways. And then the third thing is you want there to be backspin. So the backspin leads to an upward Magnus force, which keeps the ball in the air longer, counteracting in part the effect of gravity, so that it travels farther. So those are the three things: exit speed, vertical launch angle, and backspin.
How does atmosphere affect the games? Like, different ballparks have different atmospheric conditions. Like, for example, a field like AT&T Park in the Bay Area would be way different from Coors Field or Fenway Park. Tell us a little bit about that.
Remember I just said that the aerodynamic effects matter, and the principal aerodynamic effect that enters into a sort of a long fly ball trajectory is air drag or air resistance. And the amount of air resistance depends directly on the density of air. And the density of air at Coors Field in Denver, which is a mile above sea level, is about 80% of what it is at sea level. And as a result, the ball carries, to use the lingo of baseball, the ball carries quite a bit further in Denver than it does under comparable conditions at sea level. Just to give you an idea about how important drag is, so if you, the sort of a typical 400-foot home run, that sort of 400 feet is mostly a home run in virtually any ballpark, that ball, in the absence of air, would travel over 700 feet, So air resistance is a very big deal, and there's less of it in Denver than there is at sea level. There's less of it at Fenway Park than it is at AT&T Park because, generally speaking, it's colder typically. Night times in the San Francisco area, Oakland, San Francisco, Seattle's another one. All these ones that seem to be on the Pacific coast, except for the ones in the southern part of California, they're all sort of coldish kind of ballparks, and the air is more dense when it's cold than when it's warm. You know, that's why you're supposed to add air to your tires in the wintertime because the pressure is lower. Was the whole subject of Deflategate had to do with the air temperature reducing the pressure. So the temperature matters, but by far the biggest single effect in Major League Baseball is the elevation effect that you have comparing cores with virtually everywhere else. You know, that's sort of a 25-foot effect. I mean, a ball that would travel, that's optimally hit at sea level, that travels 400 feet, would travel about 25 feet further in Denver.
Are there some things that you've, over the years you studying baseball, that have really surprised you?
Well, one of the things that, one of the very first actual pieces of research that I did when I got interested in the subject was the ball-back collision. And so I did some fairly serious calculations of the ball-back collision, taking into account the dynamic nature of the bat, the fact that the bat is not a rigid object but can actually vibrate. And this is something you can actually calculate. You know, you could do things like find the sweet spot of the bat, which is where the vibrations of the bat are minimized. Batters know that when you don't hit the ball in the sweet spot, it stings. You feel a stinging sensation in your hand, and that's the bat vibrating. Well, as a direct result of these calculations, one of the things that I learned was that during the very brief instant of time that the ball and bat are in contact with each other, the batter's grip on the bat plays absolutely no role whatsoever in what happens to the ball. The collision is so fast that there's virtually nothing that the batter can do during that very short amount of time, typically less than a thousandth of a second, that can influence what happens to the ball. And that was a bit of a surprise to me at first until I thought about it, and then once I realized I understood the physics, then it wasn't so astonishing anymore. But it does go against conventional wisdom. Coaches tell you should follow through in your swing. Well, clearly, once the ball leaves the bat, nothing you do with your swing is going to matter for the ball. The other thing is that you hear announcers on TV saying, you know, from time to time, that the batter muscled that ball. Somehow he did something with the bat while the ball and bat were in contact that influenced what happened to the ball. And it simply is not the case. It just isn't true. And one of the most remarkable demonstrations of that occurred a few years ago when Todd Frazier for the Cincinnati Reds hit what I call a no-hands home run. When you look at the high-speed video of that swing, the bat was slipping out of his hand. His top hand was totally off the bat, and the bottom hand was only loosely coupled to the bat at the moment of contact. The ball traveled something like 380 feet for a home run. The bat went flying out of his hands towards the shortstop, but that provided very, very strong evidence, if you like, that the grip didn't matter. In some sense, he threw the bat at the ball. I have always argued that the batter could simply let go of the bat just prior to the ball meeting the bat, and it wouldn't make any bit of difference at all what happens to the
It might to the shortstop, though.
It might to the shortstop, absolutely.
I grew up playing baseball, and you know, I always wondered why, when you hit down the foul lines, why it always curves toward foul territory.
Yeah, that has to do with one of the topics that I got very, very interested in, which is the spin of a batted ball. So typically, So, for example, we talked before about hitting a home run. You want to get backspin on the ball. And the way you get backspin on the ball is that the bat meets the ball slightly under the center of the ball. And that will give you the ball backspin. And if you hit it on top of the ball, you'll probably hit a grounder with topspin. If the batter is out in front, the same forces, it's the frictional force between the surface of the ball and the surface of the bat that causes the batted ball to spin. If the batter is a little bit out in front of the pitch so that he's pulling it down the line, if you draw yourself a little diagram, you could convince yourself that the ball is going to be spinning in such a way that that ball ends up curving towards the foul pole. And it's the same thing happens if you're hitting to the opposite field. It also curves towards the opposite field foul pole. To convince yourself of that, you sort of have to draw a little diagram. But that's one of my favorite things to actually look for when I'm watching a game on TV, because you see that sort of thing all the time.
Well,
thank you.
Alan, it's been awesome talking to you about baseball and physics. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. I enjoy talking about it, too.
Before we let you go, real quick, what do you think it is about baseball that appeals to people of a scientific bent? Because it seems to.
That's an interesting question. You're right, it does seem to. I think that the phenomena that you see in baseball are, in some sense, simple enough that you sort of think, well, you know, we ought to be able to dig into this and really try to understand it. It turns out that that is a little bit illusory, because when you actually dig quite deeply into it, you discover that things that first appeared to be simple are really quite complicated. So Professor Adair, the one who wrote the book that first got me interested, The Physics of Baseball, was fond of saying the following: the physics of baseball ain't rocket science, it's much harder. And physicists love challenges. And so for me, this whole thing has been a challenge, and that explains, and besides the fact that I'm a big fan of the game itself, explains my own attraction to that subject.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay, thank you.
That's Alan Nathan. He is a professor of physics at the University of Illinois. You're listening to Blue Dot and our look at the science and technology of baseball. When we come back, we'll take a look at the tech side of bringing you Giants baseball on the radio from the man who makes it happen. And we're back. Welcome to Blue Dot and our look at baseball. Our next guest is Lee Jones. He's the engineer for the San Francisco Giants radio broadcasts on KNBR. And Lee, welcome.
Yes, have been. This will be my 40th year in the big leagues.
And how did you first get your job at KNBR? How did you land that?
KNBR, I was at San Francisco State, and I was graduating. And at that time, the engineering department was a union shop. And they would hire summertime relief engineers, guys who would, just come in and work to fill vacations, I think between April 1st and the end of October. And so kind of some friends told me about it, and I thought, well, what the heck, I'll go give it a shot. And persevered enough to get the job.
Tell us a little bit about, take us through a game. How soon do you have to get to the ballpark before a game starts to get things set up?
Well, for a 7 o'clock or 7:15 first pitch, We go on the air at 6:15. I'm usually there by 3:30, 4 o'clock, because at home, it's basically set up. I'll have to put up back crack mics down on the backstop, and I'll have to put up the crowd mics up in the upper deck. But and then after that, of course, there's recording and editing shows, Krugenkeit or the Bochy Show. I generally do some editing on those.
How has technology changed in your 40 years of broadcasting baseball? What are some of the things that you have now that are different or better or just different?
Well, for one thing, I do all of my highlights on a laptop, whereas I used to use two cassette machines. I don't know if any of your listeners know what a cassette machine is, but I used to do, I would have two cassette machines and a stack of cassettes of about, 10-minute cassettes. And every time there was a highlight, if you were listening to the broadcast, you'd hear me stop one cassette, pop it out, and put another one in and start it recording, and then I'd have to log them and set them up for our post-game highlights program. But now I do it all off a laptop. I can sit right there, and during the commercial break, I can edit and have it cut and set and ready to go. And there are programs on my laptop which are like, again, this is kind of inside radio, like cart machines, and you can just play things off the computer, and I line them up. And I give John or whomever is going to do the highlights a list of the highlights I have, and then I follow the recreation of the game, but the recreation hitting the highlights, and they'll cue me, and I'll fire them, and then that's the way we coordinate the thing.
What are some like memorable engineering moments where things maybe started to go sideways and you had to save them?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I have been really blessed with having just good success with the facilities provided and the equipment. Obviously, the one moment that stands out in everybody's mind, I wasn't there for, and that was the loss of the Bonds record home run. That was a microphone preamp that just decided at that moment to fail. And I try to tell everybody that equipment has a tendency to fail when it wants to fail. It doesn't pick key moments. It can be a guy just up from the minors in September grounding out to second, or it can be a historic home run. If it's going to fail, it's going to fail.
What are some of your favorite ballparks other than AT&T to broadcast out of?
I don't want to create any ill will here, but Dodger Stadium is a wonderful place to work. It's an old, old ballpark by standards, but it's the engineers around the league, we try to, set it up for our brethren when we come into town. And the guys in Dodger Stadium have set it up. It's just perfectly. You walk in there, and everything is labeled. You know exactly where it is. My sight lines are good. That's not the case in a lot of stadiums because I'm sitting behind the announcers, and sometimes I don't see the left fielder. I don't see the right fielder. If the ball goes up in the air, I have no clue where it is. I have to look at the fielders to see where they're going. But I guess Dodger Stadium might be one of my favorites. Wrigley Field is—it's a cathedral, but it's an awful place to work because it's so old and in no elevators, no escalators. It's push that equipment case up the ramp.
The last few years have been pretty special for the San Francisco Giants. Do you have a couple of favorite moments as far as being involved in broadcasts that stick out in your mind?
I think the excitement of the first time we went to the series, when John called the final out, and Mike and Dwayne are shouting over him, "We're going!" Now, as a broadcaster, that was annoying. Hey, come on, don't drown out your lead guy. But these are a couple of old ball players, and they're just excited as a couple of kids, and they're shouting that we're going to go. As far as the game goes, I can remember, I have some memories. I can't tell you who hit the ball because a lot of things tend to blend together. But when the Giants were playing Texas in the World Series, and the Ranger player hit the ball to center field, and the ball was on an arc, and it hit the top of the fence. And instead of going over it came back onto the field, and the guy thought he had a home run. Well, he was lucky to get a double. I can't remember who it was, but bottom line was, when the ball hit the top of the fence and then came back, I thought to myself, they might as well plan the parade. This thing is over. The Giants are going to win this series.
That's when you know it's meant to be.
It meant to be.
I just couldn't help but think, you know, you were talking about setting up the bat crack mics and the crowd sound mics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, creating that sonic picture, if there's things that come to mind that the average listener would have no idea, but it took a lot of doing and you know, you had to really think about how to create that sound.
What I do is I put, we call them shotgun mics. They're long, skinny mics. And TV, if any fans come to AT&T Park, if they look at the backstop on each side, they'll see two long shotgun mics mounted on the side, the very outside pole, pointed at home plate. And that allows the listeners to hear, you know, when the bat hits the ball, when the ball hits the mitt. Sometimes you get some interesting conversations, I have to admit, down there too. But, you know, you move those around. When we first started, they were mounted at a different spot, and then we moved them up. And sometimes you get fans who've had a couple of beers, and they're sitting under the bat crack mic, and they think the game's audience participation, and you go, oh, okay, well, maybe I won't be able to use that bat crack mic tonight. I'll have to switch to the other side because that fan's a little bit too loud. But, you know, things like that, you move them around. You just try to, you know, kind of thinking, how do I make this sound better? How can I get a cleaner, you know, crack sound and not be drowned out by the crowd? Just different things like that. Sometimes I know when I get home at night, and I'll be thinking about the broadcast, and I'll think, you know, maybe if I did this differently or if I do that, that'll make the broadcast a little simpler, but at the same time make it sound better.
Lee Jones, KNBR engineer for San Francisco Giants baseball, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
I did, very much so.
Well, I don't know about you, Matt, but I found that fascinating. And you're a radio engineer. Did you find it interesting to think about how you bring the crowd sounds into the radio for the audience?
Absolutely. It's God, I found myself thinking about all the different equipment that he uses and what an art form he's gotten it down to.
And to think of all of the years that he's been, you know, helping to broadcast Giants baseball and all the epic moments that he's seen, and you know how technology's changed too.
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting because radio is, as everyone who's listening right now knows, it's the theater of the imagination, right? And so a lot of thought actually has to go into how we're portraying that. So when you hear the crack of the bat, it's not like there's just a microphone in the center of the stadium picking up all the sounds. There's this huge stereo image that these people are creating. So it was a real pleasure for me to talk to Lee Jones.
I know it's going to make me appreciate it even more next time I turn on Giants baseball to listen to the sounds of the crowd and, you know, everything going on. It's just going to make it even more fun.
And this is the last blue dot before baseball season starts, and I can already smell the fresh cut grass.
That's right. And even though for now, if you're a Dodgers fan, you can call it blue dot, but for me today, it's orange and black dot. Thanks again to our guests, Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois, Alan Nathan on the physics of baseball, and radio engineer extraordinaire Lee Jones from KNBR in San Francisco.
And despite what Dave may say, this is Blue Dot.
And you can follow us at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. And I'm reminding you that from deep space, or maybe even deep center field, we all live on a pale blue dot.